is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Yiswuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Because we are facing a third wave, we can't let the allegations against one person really derail us from a process that's already been absolutely inexcusably too slow.
That's Sivwe Guarub, the Shadow Minister of Health for South Africa's Opposition Democratic Alliance, on the potential impact of the health minister's suspension. Details coming up. Also, the UN Security Council condemns in the strongest terms the killings of civilians in Burkina Faso. And Sudan implements aggressive IMF reforms in hopes of turning around its shattered economy. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Eritrea's foreign minister has sent a letter to the UN Security Council criticizing previous decades-long support by U.S. administrations for the Tigray People Liberation Movement, TPLF. The Associated Press reports that Osman Saleh's letter Monday accused President Joe Biden's administration of stoking further conflict and destabilization through interference and intimidation in the region. Ethiopian and Eritrean forces have been battling the TPLF since November, resulting in deaths that are estimated in the thousands and accusations of atrocities committed by all sides in the conflict. VOA Middle East correspondent and Istanbul bureau chief Heather Murdoch is in Tigray. An updated VOA Horn of Africa service reporter, Habta Musium, on what she is seeing on the ground.
Heather, can you share us in short about your recent visit to Aider Hospital, one of the health facilities in Tigray that treats some of the rape victims?
Yes, yesterday and today we spent time at the Aider Hospital after returning from through the countryside. And where we met there, the head of administration, and he told us a little bit about what they were suffering as a whole, which is fairly devastating, not just for the hospital workers, but for all of the patients. Being without electricity for so long has destroyed a lot of their equipment. Now they have electricity, but they can't replace a lot of the things that they need for caring for their patients. Among the patients we spoke to in the past 2 days were mostly women who have been victims of rape. And this is a widespread problem here in Tigray right now. They told us that in the past 7 months of this war, there's been more than 500 rape victims coming to them. And previously, in that amount of time, there would be more like 200. They also said, when I say they, I mean the social workers and the head of social work at the hospital. She said that the nature of the victims coming to them, the survivors, as they say, is quite different because normally when girls and women come for this kind of services, they come the next day after they are attacked. But now, because of war, roads closing, fear of stigma, fear of being killed by the rapist, women and girls are waiting months sometimes to come for help. And what ends up happening is often girls come too late for the kind of treatments they want. We talked to several of the women and girls who were victims, and their stories were harrowing and oddly similar in that each one told us a story, a different story of a time where soldiers came to their house and raped them. In some cases, it was more than two people. And in some cases, the victim, one girl we talked to, was only 16 years old. Another girl we talked to was in college, and she was questioned by the soldiers who demanded she join their military at 22 years old, and she refused. And they took her in the house and they raped her. And the most tragic part about this story is for every girl or woman that they find in Makala, the capital of this region, they say there's probably 20 others that have not come forward or are not able to come forward to get help.
Heather, earlier you have mentioned that the soldiers asked some of the victims to join them. Which soldiers are we talking about?
Both. I mean, of the victims that we have personally spoken to, they have reported seeing Eritrean soldiers and Ethiopian soldiers. And we ask them how, of course, they know who is who, and they can identify uniforms and language.
You have been in Tigray for the last couple of days. How do you describe the situation of the towns you visited and the people you talked to so far? Is there any progress, or the resentment is still there?
The conflict here is definitely still going on. The fighting itself may be mostly far away, but it's still very prevalent. Even in Mekelle, it appears to be calm, but, you know, we see soldiers coming in at night into the hospital, and hospital workers say that they have emergency cases of soldiers from fighting every day, and children with war wounds packing the hospital. And then outside of the city, it is, like, for example, we went to a town called Housen that has changed hands maybe four or five times since this war began. We went there the other day, and they had been, it was controlled by the Ethiopian Federal Forces at the time for 2 weeks. The city is things we saw in Iraq and Syria, and the infrastructure, a lot of that is destroyed. The people are quite nervous because at the time, and now, war can break out there at any moment. They've had essentially four or five wars in the past 7 months in that small town. Most of the people have fled, and we've met many of them displaced here in Mekelle and in other places. But in the town, there are a lot of people who stay there saying they don't have the capacity to move out. And outside the town, most sadly, there are mass graves scattered all around the town. We visited one with 25 people, a couple of others with two people in it. And this was a result of battles being fought, with most of the civilians fleeing. And when civilians came back, they found bodies of civilians on the street, and they buried them themselves and are hoping in that they will get the ability to, and authorities will help them rebury these bodies in a churchyard. But so far, they remain in shallow graves scattered around the town.
That was VOA Middle East correspondent and Istanbul bureau chief Heather Murdoch speaking from Tigray to VOA Horn of Africa service reporter Aptamu Siyum. The UN Security Council has strongly condemned the killings last weekend of more than 100 civilians, including children, in Burkina Faso. After expressing their deepest sympathy and condolences to the families of the victims and to the government of Burkina Faso, the council members reaffirmed that terrorism constitutes one of the most serious threats to international peace and security. They also underlined the need to bring the perpetrators, organizers, financiers, and sponsors of the reprehensible act of terrorism to justice. Abdelhamid Al-Dabiba, the Prime Minister of Libya's Government of National Unity, GNU, attended a parade of two groups of graduates from the Tripoli forces 2 weeks after he declined an invitation by Libyan National Army LNA Chief Khalifa Haftar to attend similar event in Benghazi. Experts interpret this as a message that the GNU relies on the Tripoli forces to build the Libyan army, not on those under Haftar's command. Jason Pack, a fellow at the Middle East Institute and founder of Libya Analysis in London, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi about the message the prime minister is sending to Haftar.
Since the fighting stopped in the war for Tripoli in June 2020, we've been having a symbolic fight rather than the physical fight that happened before. And that symbolic fight is over who will control Libya's security institutions moving forward. Haftar was marginalized in the UN discussions called the LPDF to make the new prime minister. And as he was marginalized, he has scheduled this parade. And the parade was going to show that he still has lots of troops under his command and he's a player. By the GNU prime minister not attending the parade in eastern Libya, but then going to a military graduation ceremony in Western Libya, he showed that he supports the Western Libyan troops and he sees them as the future for the security institutions of Libya.
Dbeibah congratulated the officers and non-commissioned officers among the graduates and said, "This graduation is part of the modernization of the Libyan army," and said, "I'm looking forward to seeing the graduates in leadership positions in the Libyan army as soon as possible." What's your take on that?
That's a very interesting statement, because Dbeibah has heretofore not touched the issue of Libya having a military or having a minister of defense, because that's a very partisan and political issue. Now, by making this statement, he's making clear that he would like to be building a Libyan army. He just knows that doing so is very delicate. So he made a statement that he would like to have a Libyan army, although he's not taking the steps such as doing SSR and DDR or bringing in foreign advisors to actually make that army happen.
While the GNU authorities consider it necessary to integrate the armed formations and militias into the regular services, Haftar calls for their dissolution and disarming, and he issued a statement in which he pointed out that his forces are not under the command of the government of national unity. What could that lead to?
Well, all of these questions probably require the following background knowledge to understand them. In Libya, there is no national army. In the West, there's a collection of militias, some of whom work together on certain missions. In the East, there's the Libyan National Army, which is not national. And therefore, the idea of the GNU to integrate the armed formations and militias into the regular services doesn't really make sense. That's a myth. There are no regular services to integrate them into. Of course, Haftar doesn't want a real Libyan army to be built, because that would make his LNA weaker and less important. So he says, "I'm freeing Tripoli because the militias that are there are a threat and I represent the real army." So these are rhetorical positions, but the key thing to understand is there is no real army, and none of the steps, whether it's graduations or parades, make us any closer to having a real Libyan army.
That was Jason Pack, a fellow at the Middle East Institute and founder of Libya Analysis in London, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Aid groups say child kidnappings by armed groups in Mozambique is being used as a war tactic. The abducted children then become victims of sexual violence and early marriage, or they could be used as fighters in the worsening conflict. A Reuters report indicates that in northern Mozambique, where an Islamist insurgency is tearing the country apart, at least 51 children have been abducted. Aid workers say the number could be much higher. The International Red Cross says it has registered more than 2,600 appeals in Mozambique from people who lost track of family members, most of whom are young adults and children. The UN Regional Director of Eastern and Southern Africa, Mohamed Malik, said the situation for children in the northmost province of Cabo Delgado is beyond precarious. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has placed his health minister, Zwelithini Mkhize, on special leave. Mkhize received praise and criticism for the way in which he guided South Africa's response to Africa's worst COVID-19 pandemic. However, the minister also allegedly awarded multi-million dollar contracts for COVID-19 communication campaigns to friends and received kickbacks in return. Here's Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Mkhize continues to deny he had anything to do with giving lucrative work to a company called Digital Vibes. The firm's managed by two women who used to work for the minister. He's described them as comrades in the ruling African National Congress, or ANC. Mkhize has told reporters the scandals tainted the government's efforts to get South Africa vaccinated and is harming him and his family.
I want to just start by saying that I fully acknowledge and take personal responsibility for the public outrage that has been caused by this Digital Vibe contract. I do not in any way undermine the voices, the views, the disappointment, the anger, and the calls for accountability that have been made by the citizens. And so for all of this, I want to unreservedly apologize. It has been a very difficult matter to...
Nkiza says he'll now focus on cooperating with an investigation into his department's relationship with Digital Vibes and his alleged role and subsequent conduct. South Africa's special investigating unit, the SIU, is probing how and why the firm was paid millions for work that should have been done by Mkhize's own communications team. Political analyst Eusebius Makhiza says President Ramaphosa hasn't acted decisively enough against his colleagues' alleged corruption.
Now, let's be clear, the minister's not suspended. This is special leave, which is a bit of a nonsense in terms of labor law anyway. It's more like a grand holiday than punishment for possible wrongdoing. And the problem is one that you and I...
But Siviwe Gwarube, the shadow minister of health for the opposition Democratic Alliance, says her party's relatively pleased that Mkhize's gone for now.
Having the minister placed on special leave, we think at least will alleviate the chances of having any undue political influence when it comes to the investigation of the SIU. Of course, it would have been a far more stronger action to suspend the minister because these allegations are quite serious. But we are welcoming...
Of far greater concern now to Gwarube is the effect Mkhize's absence is going to have on South Africa's vaccine rollout, which is still in its infancy. The minister, who's also a well-respected physician, recently set timelines according to which tens of millions of people should get jabs by the end of the year.
What's more important to us is whether or not between the DG, the administration, and the deputy minister and the current acting minister, there is some movement when it comes to these timelines, because we are facing a third wave. We can't let the allegations against one person really derail us from a process that's already been absolutely inexcusably too slow.
Ramaphosa's appointed tourism minister, Mamakola Kubai Ngubane, to fill the void left by Mkhize. She's a minister who, long before the pandemic severely eroded South Africa's tourism sector, was criticized by opposition parties for being invisible and for doing nothing to develop the industry. Makhiza says Kubai Ngubane's health experience is limited to catching a cold once a year.
The tourism minister is useless. There are very few people that would be worse than the tourism minister. You don't take one of your weakest links and in the middle of a once-in-a-generation pandemic, they have got to be in charge of rolling out a vaccination program that is already tardy and behind targets for where we need to be to get to herd immunity as quickly as possible.
But the government says it's confident that Kubai Ngubane, assisted by teams of scientists and other highly qualified officials, will successfully steer the country through COVID-19 until Mkhize returns or doesn't. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Sudan has been implementing aggressive international monetary fund reforms in hopes of turning around its economy and attracting debt relief and renewed financing. Just yesterday, according to Reuters' report, Sudan canceled old gasoline and diesel prices with new prices in line with import costs. That decision by the finance ministry saw the price of petrol nearly double, while the increase of diesel was even higher. Sudanese officials and the IMF say the reforms, which included sharp currency devaluation, would cause prices to rise and add pressure on citizens. The country's current economic woes were the driving force that led to Omar Bashir's overthrow. The new transitional government hopes its tough reforms will help it qualify for an IMF debt relief initiative that would settle its $60 billion debt. As Zimbabwe's vaccination program picks up, some inoculation centers have been turning away citizens, citing supply shortages. This comes after the government recently turned down the Johnson & Johnson vaccine under the World Health Organization's COVAX program, saying there is no capacity to store it. Reporter Kudzai Zanawashi has the details.
The government has been dispelling reports of vaccine shortages as fake news. Recently, the head of the National COVID-19 Task Force, Dr. Agnes Mahomva, gave an update on the situation.
The doses are there. They're not in the large numbers that we would like. But then that's the challenge that even the whole world is facing. Just like we started with testing, we struggled with test kits. It's the same now. Everybody, every country is clamoring for those vaccines. So we will not be getting the numbers that we have ordered in the times that we would like. But we were strategic by starting earlier than everybody else. Zimbabwe continues to lead the pack on the Africa continent. In fact, globally, we are among the leading countries in terms of vaccinations.
She urged the public not to be alarmed.
The message that I want to bring out there to the public is please don't panic. You got your first dose. You were told come on Saturday. You get there to your facility. They say, we don't have it. Don't panic because you don't have to have that second dose on that very day. Our local scientists, global scientists are actually confirming that the second dose, you don't have to have it exactly on that day. You can actually delay a little bit.
Monica Mutsangwa is the Minister of Information. She said the government expects delivery of 500,000 vaccine doses within a week.
The public is advised that efforts to ensure the availability of doses continue as a matter of priority. The Minister of Health and Childcare is redistributing existing stocks to ensure availability of the second dose.
Itai Rusike, Executive Director for the Community Working Group on Health, says more should be done to reach vaccination targets.
What is important for Zimbabwe is also to appreciate that there are a lot of countries that are in need of the COVID-19 vaccines. And it is also important for the country to appreciate that there are opportunities that are being given, you know, to the least the low and medium income developed countries such as Zimbabwe through the COVAX facility. It is unfortunate that as a country we cannot accept the offer that had been extended to us of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, because that is the only way I think as a country we can achieve the herd immunity of vaccinating at least 10 million Zimbabweans.
Government says when they initially rolled out vaccination, most centers would get similar amounts of vaccines. Now they are using data they have been collecting to make sure busy centers have stock. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinavashi from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehidi Swahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05.